I have the pleasure of introducing another first to the Jersey City Convention programs. This is the first time that we've invited our dear brother Tim Alexander to serve. We've heard of his service elsewhere, and we've been mightily blessed by it. And so now we're so privileged to be able to present him to our little convention. We're pleased to state that his subject is Father and Sons. Father and Sons. Brother Timothy.
Thank you, Brother Ray and Brother Joe. I selected that hymn this morning because it was my grandfather's favorite, John Caterba. Maybe some of you might remember him. Father and Sons. The vast majority of children, adult children who are over the age of 40, when asked about their fathers, would say something like, "Far and away the most valuable thing that my father ever gave to me was his time, his attention, and his love." Those children also said that their father's love and attention, regardless of how small the event that precipitated it, was one of the things that had an absolutely incalculable effect on their lives. And most of those children, when asked about their fathers to describe them, they used words like strength or wisdom or sacrifice or love. And many children in this age category, over the age of 40, said that their fathers were not very verbally expressive of their emotions. Their fathers did not often take the opportunity to say, "I love you." These children said that they knew their fathers loved them because of the things their fathers did for them. But rarely, if ever, were those actual words spoken. And they expressed a little bit of sadness for that, because they would have liked to have heard that. But interestingly, these same children also said that one of their own greatest regrets in life is that they themselves, the children, did not often take the opportunity to say to their fathers, "I love you, Dad." Last statistic. Many of these children, when their fathers had to do something that was a little bit unpleasant, like some serious correction or discipline or instruction, the children remember their father saying, "Someday you'll thank me." The source of this quasi-statistical information is a recent book called Wisdom of Our Fathers by a man named Tim Russert. And he's the Washington Bureau Chief for the NBC News, and he's also the moderator and managing editor for a television show called Meet the Press. He seems like a very nice man. Now, why would we quote a man like that? The reason we would quote a contemporary man like this is that we want to find out what's important to the average human being today. To find out what is important to the human heart, what fulfills that basic human longing, even in today's world where natural human affection is rapidly waning. Even in the kind of world we live in, people who have years of life experience and are able to articulate it realize the importance and the value of a father who is strong and noble and tender and loving. One of my favorite scriptures of all times is Proverbs 17, verse 6. Proverbs 17, 6 says that children's children are the crown of old men, and the glory of children are their fathers. Proverbs is saying, grandchildren, well-raised grandchildren, make a grandfather feel like a king. They make grandfathers feel like they have a crown. They're the crown of old men. And children, well-raised children, are proud of their fathers. The glory or pride of well-raised children are their fathers. So some of the translations, instead of glory, say pride. So well-raised grandchildren make a grandfather's heart feel really good. And well-raised children are proud of their fathers. That's beautiful. That shows the kind of intimate father-son relationship that the scriptures endorse. It shows the type of relationship that crosses generational boundaries seamlessly. It's a relationship that takes years of trust to develop, years of patience, years of self-sacrifice, many individual tender moments, self-effacing love for one's child. Now, these words were written in Proverbs by Solomon thousands of years ago, and they're still true today. And the reason they're still true today is because it's a basic human truth. Now, how did Solomon know this little bit of basic human truth? Beside the fact that the scriptures were inspired by God, the writing of them, Solomon knew this truth because of two reasons, I think. One, he was human, and through his observation and years of experience, he understood human nature, and this is a basic human truth. And number two, I think Solomon knew this either because he had this type of relationship with his father and he loved it, or because he did not have this type of relationship and he longed for it. Now, the relationship between a father and daughter is special. It's singular. It is a uniquely rewarding experience for a man. But talking about fathers and daughters is an activity that we'll engage in on another day. Today we'd like to talk about fathers and sons. The scriptures say a lot of different things about fathers and sons. Proverbs 29:17 says, "Correct your son, and he will give you rest. Yea, he will be a delight to your soul." More than just a delight to your mind, more than just a delight to your reputation, but he will be a delight to your soul, a delight to your very being. Proverbs 10 verse 1 says that a wise son makes a glad father, but a foolish son is the heaviness of his mother. From his son, a father receives strength and purpose and joy and courage and challenge. A father's whole life is invested in his son, and a lifetime of hopes and dreams and promise is invested in that little boy from the very beginning. It's a beautiful thing. And today we'd like to talk about two different scriptural examples of father and son relationships. And knowing what we've just discussed about that tenderness and that trust and that love that exists in this unique relationship, we'd like to look a little bit below the surface of each of these examples and see what kind of lessons that we can find. The first father and son relationship that we'd like to talk about occurs at the beginning of the book of Genesis, and you're all extremely familiar with this story. It's the account of Abraham and Isaac. Now, Abraham was part of a very strong, close family. Love for and devotion to and loyalty toward his family were very high priorities for Abraham and his family. He was one of three brothers, Haran, Nahor, and Abraham. And I think they may have had different mothers. I'm not quite sure about that. But if they did, they would be half-brothers. But Haran was significantly older than the other two. Haran had two daughters and one son. Lot was his son, and Milcah and Iscah were his daughters. But Haran died early. And after Haran's early death, Lot, Haran's son, attached himself to his uncle Abraham's family as a son. Milcah, Haran's daughter, married her uncle Nahor. And Iscah, Haran's other daughter, who by Jewish tradition is really named Sarah, married her uncle Abraham. That's a pretty close family. When Lot got into trouble and was captured by King Chedorlaomer and three other kings, Abraham put his own family and servants at risk. He armed 318 of his own men, pursued those kings all the way to Damascus, which is a tremendous distance, killed those kings' armies, destroyed them, rescued Lot and his family, and brought them back. That is real substantive family loyalty. Abraham loved his family. And the heritage that he could pass on to them was one of the most important things in his life. But he had no children. And you all know the story about Ishmael, how he was born and how he was welcomed into the family as a son. And Abraham truly loved him as though he were a son. But Ishmael still was not the child of promise. So when Isaac was finally born, not only was Isaac the fulfillment of a promise directly from God, not only was he truly a miracle of nature because his mother was 90 years old and his father was 100, but that little 6 or 7 or 8 pound little person was the culmination of a whole century of parental yearning. Abraham was 100 years old, and he waited his entire life to begin that special father-son relationship with his son Isaac. In Abraham's heart, Isaac was special. So Abraham invested everything he had in Isaac. He taught him shepherding. He taught him warfare. He taught him worship. He taught him faith. They spent countless quiet moments together. He shared his whole life with Isaac, and he included sharing the most precious gift that he had, which was God's personal promise that through Abraham and through Isaac, his son, that God would bless all the families of the earth. What a prospect, what a heritage, what a wonderful stimulus to that father and son relationship. Imagine that. But then came that terribly difficult request from God. Abraham, take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee up to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering. What a challenge of faith. What must have been going on in Abraham's mind? What a struggle. I'm sure that Abraham could have come up with many reasons to second guess God's command. The heathen people around me are accustomed to sacrificing their children to Baal. Surely God would not ask me to do the same thing as those godless heathens. Or maybe I just misunderstood God's request. Maybe I should go back to God in prayer and ask him for a clarification. Or better yet, maybe I should just wait until he approaches me again. Any human father would have been susceptible to those kinds of questions and uncertainties. But once Abraham's mind was set, once his heart was fixed on obeying God's command, whatever the cost, then he proceeded with calm and sober and measured deliberation, perhaps wondering, but never wavering. Now imagine this situation. Nowhere in Scripture is Isaac's age specifically mentioned when this sacrifice was to be offered. But commentators suggest that he was anywhere between 16 and 25 years old. So imagine this situation, even if he were only 16, a 16-year-old young man and a 116-year-old father climbing Mount Moriah together, alone. The wood is heavy, so Isaac carries it. Abraham carries the fire and the knife. Their hearts are knit with a kind of closeness that we can only imagine. Isaac loves his father completely. Isaac trusts his father completely. And innocently, Isaac asks, "Father, behold the fire and the wood, but where's the lamb?" At some point between that poignant question and Isaac being placed bound on the altar, Isaac realizes that he is the lamb. McClintock and Strong says that only when the act itself was in process did the fearful truth burst upon Isaac's young soul that he himself was the offering to be placed on the altar. So why did Isaac concede? Certainly a 16-year-old young man could have easily escaped a 116-year-old man, especially after climbing the mountain for 3 days. Was he forced? Was he overpowered? Was he outsmarted? None of these. The account tells of no struggle whatever on the part of the child of promise. It tells of no attempt to escape, no cries for help, not even a request for an explanation. It seems that Isaac surrendered himself as a willing sacrifice, and by this act he showed how thoroughly his will had confidently surrendered to the will of his father. Now this event speaks volumes about the character of Isaac, maturity well beyond his years. But this event also speaks volumes about the fatherhood of Abraham. It speaks volumes about that bond that had developed over the past 16 years as a result of Abraham's love and tender guidance and the condition that that had fostered in Isaac's heart. This event was a personal victory for the faith of Isaac, but it was also a grand victory for the fatherhood of Abraham. And it's a beautiful picture of Jesus and his only begotten, of God and his only begotten Jesus. And the parallel, of course, is inescapable. First, Abraham waited 100 years for his son to be born, what seemed like an eternity. And God also waited an eternity before creating the Logos. In Genesis 22, God said to Abraham, "Take thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest." And God also had an only begotten son whom he loved. Jesus was called my beloved son in whom I am well pleased. Now the sacrifice on Moriah was effective only because Isaac's will had perfectly conformed to his father's will. And that's a beautiful portrayal of Jesus' attitude and the condition in Jesus' heart. In John 4:34, Jesus said, "My meat, my strength, that thing which sustains my life is to do the will of my Father." In John 15, verse 10, Jesus said to the disciples, "If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, even as I have kept my Father's commandments, and I abide in his love. I live in his love." Jesus was speaking from experience here, and he was saying that the act of obedience allows one to live in that close and tender Father-Son relationship with God. He's also saying that obedience is the natural result of living in that Father and Son relationship with God. And of course, those famous words in the Garden of Gethsemane, Luke 22:42, "Father, not my will, but thine be done." It's a beautiful story, and it's a very familiar story, and one that can be related countless times without losing its power to engender praise and honor and respect for God in our hearts. Next picture. In the days of Moses, when giving the details of the construction of the tabernacle, God set a value on each man's life. Each man 20 years of age or over had to pay half a shekel as a ransom for his soul to the Lord once a year. Rich and poor alike, all men paid half a shekel to, quote, make an atonement for their souls. Exodus 30, verses 11 to 15. So each man had to pay half a shekel each year to pay what the scriptures call a ransom for his soul. Now, to our minds, it might seem that each man's life was worth more than just half a shekel. But God was establishing a principle. He was demonstrating two things. First, he was demonstrating that the value of one man's life is equal to the value of another man's life. Rich or poor alike, they all paid half a shekel, equal. And secondly, God was demonstrating that atonement with God can be achieved by paying that price which corresponds to the value of one life, a half shekel. Now, centuries later in Jesus' day, tribute collectors had been employed by the temple to encourage the payment of this tax. In Matthew 17:24, as Jesus and his disciples arrived in Capernaum, the collectors of this tax approached Peter in the street and asked him, "Doth your teacher pay this half shekel?" And Peter, with characteristic haste, answered, "Yes." Now, had Peter looked to Jesus before responding, his reply may have been different. Upon entering the house, Jesus perceived this interaction that Peter had had with the tax collectors and saw the opportunity for a lesson. And Jesus said to Peter, "What thinkest thou, Simon? the kings of the earth, from whom do they receive toll or tribute? From their sons or from strangers? Peter answered, from strangers. And Jesus said to him, therefore the sons are free. So Jesus was essentially saying, if the children of the king are free, and if this temple is really God's temple, if God is really the king of this temple, then I should be exempt from this tax because I am God's son. By this beautifully simple demonstration, Jesus was very clearly saying that he himself, the Son of God, did not need to pay a ransom for his own soul. Jesus was sinless and had no need to make atonement for himself with God. But nevertheless, Jesus continued and said to Peter, lest we should offend them, take a coin that you will find in the mouth of a fish that you will catch, and with it, pay that temple tax for you and for me. Now this group of Jesus' disciples had no money, apparently, and therefore they could not pay the temple tax themselves. So Jesus said, go to the Sea of Galilee, catch a fish, take the fish, open its mouth, find a one shekel coin, and use that coin to pay the tax for myself and for you. So Jesus was saying that he, Jesus, with his sinless life, would voluntarily pay what he did not owe for those who owed what they could not pay. It was a subtle picture of the great ransom price. You're all familiar with 1 Timothy 2:4-5. For there is one God and one mediator, the man Christ Jesus, who gave himself a ransom for all, to be testified in due time. That word, of course, ransom, is anti-lutron, and it means a redemption price which corresponds to the value of the item which it is purchasing. Jesus was offering his perfect human life in exchange to pay for Adam's no longer perfect human life. So at Calvary, Jesus purchased not only the life of Adam, but all of Adam's children. That's a very beautiful truth. And very few people know it. And yet it's the backbone of the harvest message. Notice in 1 Timothy 2, it says that Jesus gave himself a ransom for all to be testified in due time. When Paul wrote those words, that ransom price had already been paid. And it already had begun to be testified about. So why did Paul say it will be testified in due time? The thing that will be testified in due time is that that ransom is effective for all. Many people know that Jesus paid the ransom price on the cross. But very few people know that it was a ransom for all. And that will be testified to in due time. Next picture. On the last day of Jesus' human life, standing before Pilate, Jesus uttered very few words. And yet still his message was clear and evident. In front of the governor, Pilate, in a place that implied justice, Jesus stood quietly with that calm dignity and serenity which distinguishes a perfect man. Now Pilate, according to his custom, offered to release the prisoner Jesus to the Jews, coincident with the Passover. But the people chose the murderer Barabbas instead. Now, as this transaction was carried out, what began as a convenient attempt to appease an angry crowd ended up as an enduring portrait of the ransom work of Jesus. Barabbas' name means son of the father. Bar means son of, Abba means father. And Jesus was a perfect son of God. The only other originally perfect human son of the Father was Adam. So Barabbas, the son of the Father, represents Adam. And the act of the innocent Jesus going into the prison, death, so that the guilty Barabbas could come out of that prison, represents Jesus paying that ransom price. How Jesus' life would pay for Adam and all of his children. Now, throughout his life, Jesus spoke like no other man had, with authority and with power and with grace. And here we see a beautiful example of that powerful speech, even though almost no words were even spoken there before Pilate. Just a few hours later at Calvary, Jesus hung on the cross. And Jesus' mother was present. And she stood there witnessing an event that no mother should ever have to witness. On the day that Jesus died, it was as though a large sword came down from heaven and pierced the earth and became the cross on which Jesus was crucified. And Jesus' mother was watching that event. And that cross, as it stood on Golgotha, resembled the image of a large sword with the hilt piercing the earth. And I wonder if Mary's mind went back to the words of the prophet Simeon. Remember when Jesus was 8 days old and Joseph and Mary took Jesus to the temple, and there was a devout man of Israel whose name was Simeon. And he took Jesus and picked him up and held him up to heaven, and he prayed to God and he said, "Lord, now you can let me die in peace because I have seen your salvation, the light to lighten the Gentiles and the glory of thy people Israel." I think that Simeon probably said those words with real passion. And then Simeon turned to Mary and said, "And yea, a sword will pierce through thine own soul also." And those fearful words certainly did come to pass. Mary's heart was broken, surrounded and enveloped by nearly inhuman grief. But as that impossible sorrow descended upon Jesus' mother's heart, a parallel sorrowfulness descended upon Jesus' father's heart also, God. Jesus' father, God, keenly felt the pain of watching his only begotten be sacrificed for the life of the world. God was watching and fulfilling that picture that he had asked faithful Abraham to illustrate thousands of years before. As Jesus left Pilate and made his way toward Calvary, bearing up under the weight of that cross, God was watching. And perhaps God was experiencing the same kind of emotions that Abraham experienced watching Isaac carry that heavy wood up Mount Moriah. So we've talked about three different pictures of the ransom. We've talked about Abraham and Isaac. We've talked about the temple tax. And we've talked about the meaning of the name Barabbas. But now let's talk about a miracle in Mark chapter 9. In Mark chapter 9, you remember Jesus just came down from the Mount of Transfiguration, and he encountered his disciples, and I think the scribes were discussing with them, and apparently there was some contention, and so Jesus knew that there was a problem. And in verse 14 it says, "And when he came to his disciples, he saw a great multitude about them and the scribes questioning with them." And he asked the disciples in verse 16, "What are you questioning with my disciples?" And one of that multitude, a father, came to Jesus and said, "Master, I have brought to thee my son, which hath a dumb spirit, and wheresoever he taketh him, he teareth him, and he foameth, and he gnasheth with his teeth, and pineth away. And I spake to his disciples that they should cast him out, and they could not." So this man brought his son to the disciples and said, "Please heal him," but they were unable to do it. Jesus was not there because he was up on the Mount of Transfiguration. So when he came down, the father approached Jesus and said, "Can you help me?" In verse 20 of Mark 9, "And they brought him, the son, to Jesus, and he saw him, and straightway the spirit tore him, and he fell on the ground wallowing and foaming. And he asked his father, 'How long ago since this came up to him?' And he said, 'Of a child. And oftentimes it hath cast him into the fire and into waters to destroy him. But if you can do anything, please have compassion and help us.' And Jesus said to him, 'If you can believe, then all things are possible to him that believes.'" Now imagine that situation. Imagine watching your son in that condition. This is a wonderful miracle. This man's son, from a very young age, was possessed by a demon. This man's son, whom he loved, was possessed by a demon. Imagine that terrible suffering described. It's hard enough to experience pain and suffering yourself, but it's even harder to watch your children go through it. So imagine this father. This broken-hearted father brought his son to Jesus to be cured because the disciples could not cast out that demon. And the father told Jesus that the demon had time after time tormented this boy, cast him into water and fire to destroy him. And the father was heartsick, reading between the lines. And even when that boy was brought to Jesus, the demon cast the boy to the ground, wallowing and foaming. And every tender heart was crushed that witnessed this tragedy. And every ounce of human kindness longed for the time when this poor boy would be relieved of this difficulty. And only Jesus could do it. So with desire in his heart to help the father, and with compassion in his heart to help this child, Jesus offered the only solution, faith in him. So Jesus commanded this demon to leave the child. And he said, "Come out of him and enter no more into him." And the demon departed. But as the demon departed, he cruelly extracted every last shred of suffering that he could from that boy. It said he threw him down on the ground, wallowing and foaming. And when that demon was finally gone, the boy was left lying on the ground as one dead. Even the spectators were confident that this poor boy actually had died. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up and reunited him with his father. Now, does that story sound familiar? This miracle is a striking picture of the redemptive work of Jesus. The father in the miracle is God, and the little boy in the miracle is Adam and the rest of the world of mankind. Just like Adam, the boy in our miracle, was born healthy. He was born perfect on the plane of human perfection. But at a very young age of a child, he was possessed by the demon and entered this terrible condition of suffering. Just like the boy, the world of mankind will be nearly destroyed by Satan's attempts. First by water at the end of the first dispensation, and then by fire at the end of the second dispensation, where Satan is attempting to really destroy that child. It's a beautiful illustration of the end of the first and the second dispensations. Jesus not only commanded Satan to come out of the human race, but he also will forever prevent Satan from re-entering the human race. Just like the little boy, the human race will be left almost completely lifeless. But Jesus, the Redeemer, will lift up the whole race by their hand, raise them to a standing position, and present them back to their Father. That's really a beautiful picture. From the very beginning, when the Logos said, "Here am I, send me," until the very end, when all tears are wiped away from all eyes, Jesus has remained the faithful Son of God, the Redeemer of the world of mankind. And because of that great work, every one of us can eagerly look forward to the time when there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. So we've talked about two examples of fathers and sons. The first is Abraham and Isaac. Abraham representing God and Isaac representing Christ. The second example was the father and son in the miracle in Mark chapter 9. In both of these examples, that father is God. In the first example, the son is Christ, and the second example, the other son is Adam. And these two examples of fathers and sons are a beautiful summary of the entire plan of the ages, God's plan of salvation. We look with tender sympathy at that little boy who was cast into the fire and into the water. And we imagine what his father was feeling. And we rejoice in the healing and the comforting of that little boy. Imagine being there, standing there, watching that miracle. And just, I think it would be overwhelming. We also rejoice in the reestablishment of the father-son relationship that had been lost between that father and that little boy who was suffering in that condition. And then we look at Abraham and Isaac. And we look at Isaac with respect, and we admire him. We admire his strength of character. We admire the depth of his trust of God. We admire the willing submission that he had developed, even at that tender young age. And we look at the fatherhood of Abraham, how skillfully and how carefully he fathered his young son from the very beginning, how Abraham's loving guidance and tender care had helped foster that faithfulness in Isaac's heart, how Abraham's complete trustworthiness actually earned Isaac's complete trust, even in the face of an unimaginable request. We think about Abraham and Isaac's father-son relationship. We think about how fortunate Isaac was to be the child of promise, to have a father like Abraham, a father who was completely reliable in every condition, in every way, a father who was eager to both protect and challenge Isaac, a father who desired eagerly to spend countless quiet moments with his son. And then we think of the words of the Apostle Paul in Galatians 4:28, where he said that you, brethren, as Isaac was, are also the children of promise. And we realize that every benefit and every privilege that Isaac had with Abraham is a privilege that God is offering to you. God is eager to deepen and to widen and strengthen and develop that father-son relationship with you. Paul says in Galatians 4 that God sent his son to redeem those who were under the law so that you might receive that adoption of sons. Because you are sons, God hath sent forth the spirit of his son into your hearts so that you may now cry, Abba, Father. It's a beautiful opportunity. It's a wonderful privilege. It's a privilege that we oftentimes, too often, allow to become commonplace. So don't allow that to become commonplace. Think of the words of Isaac's son Jacob in Genesis 32:9, where he said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, I am not worthy of the least of all thy mercies and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto me. So now think back to that survey we did at the very beginning. And about those five items that we mentioned, that adult children mentioned about their fathers. And think about whether they are true between you and your Heavenly Father. They said that far and away, the most valuable thing that my father ever gave me was his time, his attention, and his love. They said that the words that describe my father best are wisdom, strength, sacrifice, and love. That's just like God's four attributes: wisdom, power, justice, which demanded the sacrifice, and love. They said that I haven't actually heard him say the words, I love you, but I know he loves me because of everything he's done for me. They also said that one of my greatest regrets in life is that I haven't often enough taken the opportunity to say, I love you, Dad. So don't fail to take that opportunity. Say those words. Speak them like a melody. Because he loves to hear them. They also said that in difficult times, in times of discipline or correction, that their father would often say, someday you will thank me. For the world of mankind, that day is in the kingdom. But for you, that day is today.